Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Susan, Laris, and Dan, and I am so happy to welcome you all today on this spring day when I think many of us in the spring think about new directions, new beginnings, new projects. And today I have a returning guest that I know everyone enjoys, and I certainly enjoy talking with him. Dr. Alan G. Hunter is back on the show, and he is going to be talking to us today about an area where he has spent over 30 years of his professional life working. We are going to talk about the soul work of telling your story. And this is very much a part of Alan's book, Write Your Memoir, which indeed has the subtitle, The Soul Work of Telling Your Story. And this book, which I must say I continue to work with myself because it's not a book to rush through. It has a lot of very helpful exercises, and Alan asks us to use these exercises and really be thoughtful about them. And what we are going to talk about today is how writing about your life helps you come alive, that it's much more than you may think it is on the surface, and you discover that when you start to get into it. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about Alan Hunter. He has a PhD in English literature from Oxford University. He's been on this show a number of times talking about some of his 12 books that are out there, including Gratitude and Beyond, Five Insights for a Fulfilled Life, The Path of Synchronicity, Align Yourself with Life's Flow, The Six Archetypes of Love, From Innocent to Magician, Spiritual Hunger, Integrating Myth and Ritual into Daily Life. I could go on and on. I'll list a couple more. Stories We Need to Know, Reading Your Life Path in Literature. And I really do want to mention one because we're going to be talking about memoir today, his father's memoir, which is called From Coastal Command to Captivity, The Memoir of a Second World War Airman. Now, Alan Hunter is a full professor at Curry College in the Boston area, and he has worked with troubled adolescents. He's taught prisoners, and he continues to have a very active spiritual counseling practice as well. His website is on the show page if you can see it, and that is alanhunter.net, and his name is always spelled with two L's, A-L-L-A-N, hunter.net. So I am just so happy. Hopefully the lines will work more quickly. They're a little slow today, so I'm about to bring Alan on the line here, and we'll hopefully not have too much of a delay. Hello, Alan. Welcome back.
Hello. Lovely to hear your cheery voice, and it's such a delight to be on the show again. Thank you.
Well, this topic I know is very near and dear to your heart and really the heart of your work, isn't it, Alan?
Yes, it really is. It's when we think about the stories we tell ourselves about who we are, sometimes we tell ourselves stories that aren't necessarily helpful. So memoir is a way of examining the stories that we think we're living and perhaps changing them, because as they say, you change your story, change your life.
Yes, yes. Now, something I thought we should get at right at the beginning because I realize that there may be a little confusion about this term memoir, and that sometimes people think of autobiographies, losing my voice here, autobiographies instead of memoir work. And I wonder if you, right at the outset, could clarify the difference.
Oh, yes, it's a very important one. An autobiography, which is what most people have perhaps encountered, is the story of one's life from day one until yesterday. And so it is huge and all-inclusive and usually a bit cumbersome. But a memoir, which is usually much more accessible, is something quite different because in it the author chooses part or several parts of his or her life and says, these are the important moments. So you might say an autobiography is the story of one's life, but a memoir is the story that is chosen from a life. And as such, it can be much more illuminating, much faster. You know, with an autobiography, presumably you have to say all the people you're related to and all that sort of stuff, which is fascinating if you happen to be very, very famous already. But yet many people say, you know, I want to tell the story of my life because there's something important in this part of it right here that I'm going to focus on. That's a memoir. And important to recall that some folks have written more than one memoir. Frederick Buchner, the spiritual counselor, has written four of them, and they're very short.
Yes.
And they're all about different parts of his life. And so a memoir is a story chosen, selected, as it were, from someone's life.
Yes. Now, when we talk about, you know, telling the stories of our lives, and if we're thinking, you know, not even just for ourselves, but for publishing, something else that arose in my mind as I was reflecting on this is that many of us who are choosing to write books in the spiritual community or other sorts of writing, we know that we're going to be telling stories from our lives as part of those books. You do this. You do this often in your books, and it's really common. The reason why I'm getting at this, because I know there tends to be, some people will say, well, I'm not ready to write a memoir, or, you know, I'm not, you know, that's not a project I'm looking at right now. And I'm beginning to see how this sort of writing comes up in a good portion of nonfiction, if you choose, and actually fiction too, for that matter. And so I wonder, am I correct in this? I mean, that these sorts of things, even in publication, I mean, they can come up in all kinds of work that you might publish.
Yes, oh, absolutely. A gentleman I'm in contact with at the moment, he has just written his memoir as a novel, and he liked that idea. Personally, I think that when you put something into novel form, it is changed, perhaps, unless you're very skillful, in ways that are not very helpful. But other people I know have used portions of their lives, literally saying, you know, this is a teaching tool. I've lived through it. Here is some wisdom that I can pass on to somebody else. And so memoir comes into many, many forms. And it's wonderful today, of course, that there are so many different ways of doing things. You know, we can choose very easily. But coming from that primal personal experience, that felt experience, is enormously powerful. And it's not just about saying, you know, this is where I grew up and this is who I am. It's almost always about, this is what I've learned and I would like to pass it on to whoever is reading, whether it's grandchildren who are just going to read the typescript, or whether one's looking to create something that will sell, you know, thousands of copies. There is a life lesson in each case that someone feels strongly enough to want to relay to others.
Yes. And, you know, when you speak of this, something that may be sold to thousands of people, there can be, I realize, reflecting on this, there are pluses and minuses to thinking about that. On the one side, if you think, you know, this really could be sold to a lot of people, that can actually make you maybe a little more self-conscious. On the other hand, if you say, oh, this is going to be sold to thousands, millions of people, you know, then it becomes an ego exercise. And you talk about in one point of your book about entertainments, you know, that sometimes you may not even be writing something real and that it's more of entertainment.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you could reflect on that a little bit, because this whole business of lots of people and where is this going, it's a really core area as you get going at the outset thinking about it.
Oh, yes, it's a core area. So perhaps I would point out that my emphasis is on working with people to bring to the surface the stories of their life or lives. Some people seem to have lived enough for several lifetimes. And my emphasis is never going to be on the commercial side of things.
Yes.
You can always make a good commercial story by telling lies. You can
exactly.
spice it up. But my emphasis is on a very basic fact, and that is almost all of us, we reach a point in our lives when we say, oh, there's something I want to communicate, and I think telling my story is the way to communicate it. And when we do that, what we're doing is we're entering a sort of conversation with our own history. And as we enter that conversation, if we do it honestly, what we'll find is that we, as writers, as people, as thinkers, that we are transformed by the ability to stand outside our own experience and ask questions about, well, what does it mean? What was it showing me? What sort of world is this that I live in? And when we do that, when we reach for that deep truth, what's happening is much more valuable to our souls than 100,000 copies being on the best-selling list of the New York Times. Because that, when we tell our truth, it will transform us, and it will lead us to a much more valuable space than mere money. That is why I called this book The Power Write Your Memoir, but the soul work of telling your story. And I might also say that all of the memoirists I've worked with have found that by going to that soul space, by being honest, by being thoughtful, by being compassionate for themselves, all of them have entered what I can really only describe as a healing space. And which of us doesn't need to be healed? You know, this is a cruel world. We get lumps and bumps. And if we don't heal ourselves, we can't grow our souls. So, you know, my main emphasis is, first of all, we have to get to that space, talking honestly, with clear eyes, looking at what happened, realizing that we had perhaps more input into some of the disasters than we might wish to say, and perhaps more input into some of the successes than we might wish to say. But a memoir won't be worth reading unless you go to that space first. It might sell a gazillion copies, in which case, hallelujah, great, I'd be very happy. But it has to go to that space first for the good of the writer. In your lovely introduction, you mentioned my father's memoir, which he and I worked on. He then died at the age of 82 and bequeathed me the papers. And he said, you know, do something with them. So I worked at them and turned them into a book, which is why it appears under my name, although it's his memoir. But I mention that because he was traumatized by World War II. And I think the work we did together was soul work, because gradually as he wrote, he began to notice important things, such as he had been traumatized, but he'd also been very fortunate. He'd discovered that it was possible to build a life when almost everything had been taken away from him. He was in a prisoner of war camp for nearly 4 years and was, thinner than a rail, 6 foot tall and 90 pounds. He was pretty skinny. And at the time, he thought he'd had a rough deal from life. But as he began to write his story, he began to see that actually perhaps his life had been saved so that he could learn and do more. And it, for him, it was a profoundly healing process. And I mean that because, you know, my mother, before she died, she told me that he would wake her up in the middle of the night. He was fast asleep, but he would be fighting with her, sometimes trying to throttle her. And he thought he was fighting in, you know, who knows what he thought he was fighting, some demon.
Yeah.
But he would also wake up shouting, don't shoot, don't shoot, which I'm pretty sure we could trace directly back to one of his escape attempts from the prisoner of war camp when they came up out of the tunnel and they found themselves surrounded by German soldiers pointing rifles at them. And that's the sort of thing that would wake him up in the middle of the night. By the time he'd finished his memoir, he was in a place of much greater calm and acceptance and peace. And in some ways, it was the best gift he could ever have given to himself. I was there to help him. But he gave this gift of peace and wisdom to himself. Now, I've mentioned him in some detail. One of the other people I mentioned in the book was actually a man who was incarcerated in another type of prison, a maximum security prison here in Massachusetts.
Yes.
And he wanted to tell his story because he'd been offered money for it for a movie deal.
And, well, there you go.
Know, he did get some money. The movie still hasn't been made, but but whilst he was working on this with me, he would quite often say, you know, I never told anyone about this. And then he'd say, you know, I never thought about it this way before. This is opening my mind. And I think that during that process, what he was doing was a vital part of what I can only describe as rehabilitating himself. Now, you know, writing his life story was not the only thing that rehabilitated him. He took classes, he got some skills, he learned how to behave. But I think the writing of his life story was a major component in him saying, wow, I did that. Why did I do that? Why was I such an idiot as to do that and that? And he was asking questions. He was finding answers. He's now out in the world. I hear from him from time to time. He's on the other side of the state. And he's doing very well, being honest and decent. And, you know, he's a productive member of a family. And, you know, he's changed his life. And to go back to my earlier point, he's changed the story he was telling himself about what his life could be. He thought all he could be was kind of a thief of cars, of high-speed cars who ran drag races and made fools out of the police. He thought that was the best thing he could be at the age of 19, or actually it was 18. He thought that was all there was to life. And then he was arrested for another crime, which wound up with him spending nearly 20 years in jail. And at the end of that time, writing his story brought him to a soul space. Now, that's not true of many people in jail, especially maximum security jails. The recidivism rate, the rate at which people reoffend and return, is alarmingly high. It's something, the statistics vary, it's between 80 and 90%. You know, how did he beat the odds? I think telling that story, writing his memoir for his own truth, was one of the things that turned his life around. And that's why I do this. You know, lives change. Not because I change them, but because people embark on a journey in which they're able to ask themselves the questions that perhaps they wouldn't have been ready to ask before. And so that is soul work, and it brings people to a much better place.
Yes. You know, you do a lot of exploration of the lies that we tell ourselves, or how, you know, we'll start writing and then we'll say, no, you know, that isn't quite the way it was, or and how we come to a much greater understanding of reality through this. How much, it seems like this is something that you have to give yourself time to do. I mean, I don't know. I mean, how quickly do you recognize those sort of, I mean, I suppose sometimes right away, but could you reflect on this a little bit, this process of what we're really telling ourselves through our stories?
I'll respond to the first bit of that, the time aspect. I mean, some people say, oh, well, when I've got time, I'll reflect. When I've got time, you know, I haven't got time for this now. And that's, you know, we all lead busy lives. But one of the first things I try to deconstruct for the people I work with is it doesn't need a lot of time.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. I say to people, I say, if you can commit to about 10 to 15 minutes a day, maybe 4 days a week, and if you can do that regularly, then you can very rapidly get to the core of what it is you need to look at. And people say, oh, that can't be right, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. I say, well, it's the same thing as going to the gym. You know, you have, it has to be a little bit of discipline, and you have to grit your teeth and say, rrr. And then after a while, it becomes kind of a positive addiction, and you say, oh, I'll just do my 15 minutes today. And I do tell people not to spend longer than 15 minutes to begin with. It's better to stop in the middle of a sentence and say, oh, my 15 minutes is up, and then the next day you know where you're going to begin again. You're going to begin right there in that sentence that you stopped at. And many famous writers have done exactly that for their own writing. And Joseph Conrad used to stop in the middle of a page, you know, so that he would know where he was going to start again tomorrow. Bill Littlefield, who's a novelist I work with actually here at Curry College, he says, you know, slow down and love your story. And he limits, and he's a professional writer, you know, but he says, I limit myself, he says, to 2,000 words a day. Now, he's a professional writer, so he's doing it for more than 15 minutes.
Yes.
And I said, but Bill, you know, you're so good at this, you know, you could rattle off 2,000 words in, you know, in an hour. And he says, yeah, but it won't be quality if I don't slow down. And that's the essence of writing about your life. It slows us down. Talk is cheap. We can talk about stuff till we fall over from exhaustion. But writing it can slow us down a little bit, and we say, ooh, yeah, I guess that did happen that way. Ooh, well, just what did it look like? And causes us to reflect on something that perhaps we haven't reflected on, or something we've overlooked. And so the time element, 15 minutes a day, most people can manage that. And I tell people, don't be worried if, you know, the first time you sit at the desk or the computer or the kitchen table, if nothing happens for 15 minutes. I say, just stay there and be used to it. And then the next day, come back and stay there, even if you just write at the top of the page, oh, I don't know how to do this. But once you're in the habit, it gets the unconscious part of the mind working. And if you stay with it, you'll find, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll just write a couple of sentences about this or a couple of sentences about that.
Yeah.
Our unconscious mind is a little bit like an unruly child. And if you want an unruly child to help you, dig the garden, the last thing you say to it is, you know, here, unruly child, here's a shovel, help me dig the garden, because the kid will throw it down and run away. What you do is you say, you don't have to do anything, just stand there and lean on this shovel, and I'm going to, you know, we'll just be here.
Uh-huh.
And pretty soon that unruly child starts prodding around and saying, well, what do we do here anyway? which are the weeds? And this is the way we train our unconscious. One of the things, I have many exercises in the book, and
yes.
they are all there for one reason, and that is you have your strongest ally and your most formidable opponent in the same guise, and that is your inner resistance, your unconscious. And your unconscious will say, the moment you sit down for your first 15 minutes, your unconscious will probably say, I don't have time for this. You don't have time for this. You know, you're going to be late.
Yes.
You know, blah, blah. It'll try anything to stop you telling your story.
Yes.
And the thing is, that is a powerful, powerful friend if you can win this friend over. So I have my writers do a couple of things. One is, I say, when you're ready, write a little contract with yourself, which says, I, and you fill in your name, I pledge to spend 4 days a week, Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, spending 15 minutes each day at my desk, and then you sign it to yourself.
Yes.
If you can't do that, you might not be ready yet. You might not be, and that's okay. The story will still come, but you might not be ready yet. And then I say to people, make sure that you have that 15 minutes and you don't go on Facebook, you don't answer the phone. It's your time. And sometimes that means you just have to clean one end of the kitchen table and say, for these 15 minutes, this is my time. Some people do this late at night when the kids can't interrupt, or early in the morning, and they say, whatever this is my time. Sit there with your coffee or your tea, but don't do anything else for those 15 minutes apart from be there with the paper, with the blank screen. And then at the end of the 15 minutes, I tell people, I say, give yourself a reward. And a reward is really important, like a cookie, just one, you know, a chocolate. You know, or some people say, well, I wait until afterwards to have my nice cup of coffee, or I then go out to Starbucks. But the point is, make it a small reward and make it right then. Don't save it for tomorrow. It's got to be right then. And you know what happens? The unconscious begins to say, oh, well, this isn't so bad. We sit here, we think about stuff, and then we get a reward. Oh, okay. And so I promise you, every writer I've worked with has said that, you know, over a couple of days, they'll find that they turn up at that little designated space, so those designated 15 minutes, and the unconscious is saying, hey, I like this. You know, you could write that story about the time you were in the car crash, couldn't you? Yeah, that would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And your unconscious is beginning to say, it's okay. You can let down your guard. It's all right. When that happens, my goodness, that's when the memories begin to arrive. So the essence of my book, and the reason I wrote it, is because this is a process that can be destroyed if you don't get your unconscious self on your side. But if you do, if you flatter it a little bit, if you give it some space, I promise you it will take you into memories that you didn't realize you'd preserved, and it will take you to realizations that will you know, make your socks fall off with surprise. So that's what can happen in a very short amount of time.
Yes. Now, and I'm willing to volunteer. I've been doing a lot of writing in the last year that you're aware of. So.
Yes.
And what I wonder about is when you write about your life, what happens when it intermingles? Like, okay, you let your unconscious go, and you're telling a story, but you're also maybe almost doing a form of journaling at the same time. Is this unusual to, I mean, it seems like it brings itself forward to the present day in some ways, the lessons and things, but And so I'm just curious if this happens to people where it kind of, I know it's different than journaling what we're talking about, but do you see what I'm saying, where you're talking about your life and then somehow it it comes to the present while you're talking.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the core of it as well, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes.
You live in the present, and you're looking at your life from the present, and so inevitably there's going to be a double focus, isn't there? You look back and say, gosh, you know, when I was a teenager, I was doing all this stuff, and now I look back on it, it strikes me that I got into some habits of thinking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you are looking back, but you're also in the present. And the key, again, here is not to look back at the past in a sort of I'm on the mountaintop looking back at my past life sort of way, because that interposes a huge distance. I think the best way, and my writers tell me the best way, is if you look back on your life, you say to yourself, well, what did it feel like then? You know, what was back in 1985? What was I wearing? What were people wearing? What music was on the radio? What was the fads? What was going on? And when you start asking those questions, you say, oh, right, you know, we were wearing those peculiar jackets and those strange pants or whatever, and we were all talking about this or that. Oh, and then more memories come back with greater clarity. And that's why we sometimes have to sort of take off our gloves and play in the dirt a little bit and say, well, gosh, that was over 30 years ago or over 20 years ago or over 10 years ago. What did it feel like? And so from that point of view, obviously we can't leave the present. It all has impact on the present, as you described. But the more we can go back to that space and feel it as it was, the better we can understand it.
Yes. And I will say, it's magical, isn't it? I mean, you really remember. I mean, I will speak firsthand. You really start to remember things that you just didn't even realize. And you know their memories, too. That's another thing, though. I mean, there's a good question. And I feel like you really do. I mean, my feeling of it is that sometimes you really have to stretch to remember something. But what about this business of false memory? You know, you hear about this so much, how we create a lot of memories, or they're planted by people, or, you know, whatever. Can you help us with that? Because as you're writing honestly about your life, you surely want to get it right as best you can, and maybe this is the self-correction. But, yes, let's go into this a little bit more, because it's so important to really remember.
Yes, it really is, because the memory is a fickle thing. We tend to remember things, all of us remember things slightly differently. Two people witnessing the same event, as any lawyer will tell you, will see slightly different things. And if you want to be a destructive type of lawyer, and they're out there, it's easy to make mincemeat of such a witness. You know, you can say, well, did this really happen? So-and-so. No, but that's not what we're on about. We realize that memories change, but we also realize that if a memory has stuck, there was an emotional component. And we don't remember things that have no emotional component. So if you were to ask me, what did you have for dinner last Tuesday? Actually, I don't know. It was only last Tuesday. I do know that it was not an unusual dinner, or I would have remembered something about it. But if you ask me what I was doing on my grandmother's 95th birthday when we all went out to dinner, I can remember what we ate, and I can remember who was there and where it was, because there was an emotional component. This old, old lady who was to die shortly afterwards, that was her last hurrah, and we knew it. So memories have truth in them, although some of the truth may be a little biased, a little personal, and that's okay, because it's not until we've brought them to the surface that we can question and say, you know, did it happen the way I thought it did? You know, I think it did. Have I talked to anyone about it? Well, then we can begin to ask questions about why we needed the memory to be a certain way.
Yes.
Now,
that's
second part of your question about false memory is fascinating, because I have several colleagues that I've worked with who deal with trauma and memory and false memory and the various ways of dealing with false memories. And one of the things they have come up with again and again is that the false memory movement is actually predicated on very little strong, firm evidence. Mm. Yes, there are people who are mentally distressed who create memories because they are somewhat delusional or have great need to create those memories. But the whole false memory dispute is not nearly as powerful as we think. And the trauma community, those who work especially specifically with those with trauma, is a little divided on this. Some of them say, well, there are false memories and they can be implanted, and I'm sure they can for the very susceptible. But on the whole, false memories are not usual, and they don't seem to exist in quite the way that their supporters once upon a time thought they did, namely that anybody can be persuaded to remember anything.
Yeah.
So our memories may be unreliable at times. They may lead us astray sometimes, but it's unusual to get a major event as a false memory. And when we know that, it frees us as memoir writers to say, well, you know, I know something happened then. I don't know what it is or was. I've managed to blank out some of it. Perhaps it was not a happy memory. And then rather than saying, oh, it's just a false memory, we're able to say, no, there's something in there that's kind of eating at me. Will I get to the bottom of it? Who knows? But if one doesn't ask the questions, one can't get to the bottom of it. And that's the part of the problem with the more zealous people on the false memory front, where they say, well, there's no evidence, didn't happen, you know, client making it all up. Well, gently, says I. It may not be quite as it seems from that point of view.
Yes, you know, I'm really glad that you've cleared that up a bit, because it's in the popular culture right now. Because a lot of those extra, I don't know, it was some years ago, they were just making the circuit. I don't know, you heard a lot about the false memory thing. And so you know how that is with culture. Mm. We tend to get embedded in our psyches that this thing exists. And I think that it's helpful that you talk of this, because it's important if you're really wanting to believe that you're remembering accurately. It's important to know that, you know, if you're really in the exploration, you are indeed remembering as best you can.
Yes.
So
as
that's
best
helpful.
You can, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it. You always have to add that. Now, you know, you talk about trauma, people who've been through trauma. And I know there's a story in your book about a woman, I think in one of your classes, it tells a story about, you know, past abuse or it's a difficult story. And I wonder if we can explore this a little bit more, that, you know, if someone has something traumatic that they're, you know, maybe have partially forgotten or are trying to recall, you know, and maybe even are a little afraid of going back there, address that, because that's a really, really important area of healing.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a delicate area, and I've dealt with it a great deal. I probably should say more than I would like to, because it's never easy to observe somebody who's been traumatized, although it's often a great privilege to work beside them as they begin to work it out in whatever ways they can. Traumatic memory is, as far as we can tell, stored in a different part of the brain to ordinary memory. And so it's stored there for self-protective reasons, as far as we can ascertain. Namely, so that it doesn't knock us off our feet when we remember things. The trouble is that it can then resurface in a series of flashbacks triggered by something. And we all have little bits of this. We all have triggers. So when we see something we don't like, we find ourselves overreacting. And we realize, oh, right, that's because it reminds me of something when I was age 7 or when I was aged 8, and that's why I'm overreacting. So we all have a little bit of this. But deep trauma, those people who've been sexually abused or beaten or any of these things, this is something that comes up a fair amount in memoir. And often it arises because the individual is saying at an unconscious level, I think I need to address this now. I think I need to make a little bit of a foray into this because I've carried it for too long. And when that happens, you know, it's both very daunting for the individual who probably needs support at that stage and very liberating because they're beginning to say, you know, I think I see what was going on and it's not my fault. And it wasn't my doing. You know, I behave in odd ways sometimes, but perhaps there's a good reason for that. And so the liberating aspect of dealing with trauma is not to be ignored. And yet it can be very hard work. And so I often have to say to my writers working with me, I have to say, you decide if you're ready to write about any of this. You might not be, not just yet.
Yeah.
You will be ready, and that's okay. But you get to decide the pacing of what you do. And this, they greet this information often with a huge sigh of relief. Oh, I don't have to do that. Oh.
Yeah.
And paradoxically, of course, that's when they become more able to do it because
of
it's
course,
like,
great.
And sometimes, of course, they really can't do it, and they say, you know, I just can't face that now.
Yeah.
In which case, you know, there's no compulsion because simply knowing that something unpleasant exists and then saying, I'm not going to go back to that space, that can be very healthy too. That can be somebody choosing positivity and saying, you know, there are bits of me that aren't healed, but most of me is pretty okay. I'll focus on the okay bits.
Yeah.
And that's a different aspect of soul work. We don't have to turn over every stone and look under every rock and ferret into every corner. You know, that's not what it's about. We do this work to make a better future, not to wallow in the past and say, woe is me. And so there are many, many ways forward. It's as individual as the people are individual. And one has to be absolutely respectful of people's limits and say, you know, this might not be the time. This may never be the time. We'll just acknowledge there is something unpleasant here, and we'll move on to the good things that one was able to do with one's life. And that's, after all, what matters. As Andrew Bienkowski says in his personal memoir, he says, most of our lives is determined by two things. The first is what happened to us before the age of 10, before we had any power. And the second thing is what we choose as our reaction to those events. And I would extend that and say, you know, most of our lives is determined by two things, what happened to us and how we choose to respond.
Yes.
And so it's possible for somebody to have difficult traumas in his or her life and say, you know, maybe in this memoir, in this book, in this version of my life, I don't need to go there because I'm looking at something else. And that's exactly what they need to do.
Yes. Well, that I suppose that's definitely listening to your unconscious at that moment.
Well,
what is it guiding you to do is the question, always.
When we make that which is unconscious fully conscious, then we're in charge. But if it's sitting there and we're not aware of how much it's running our lives then we're not in charge. Then we're not really running our own lives. We're being run by our past. So that's what we want to avoid, really.
Yeah, kind of a heavy area here. But it's important because, I heard an echo there for a second. So hopefully it won't stay. By the way, I always do this because I feel gratitude is in order when this happens. We are once again on the front page of Blog Talk Radio, and I'm thankful to them because, yes, very
lovely.
Thankful that they're featuring us today. So, because this is an important topic. It's so important
super.
To reach people.
Well,
anyway.
It is. I mean, that's why that's why I wrote the book. It was I realized a lot of people needed the sort of guidance that seemed to work well for the people I was working with. And I thought, you know, you don't have to travel across the country and come to one of my workshops. You can get quite a lot of it from the book.
That is absolutely true. And honestly, as I said at the beginning of the show, I'm still working with the book. I mean, sometimes my own experience was just engaging in writing rather spontaneously. So, and I'm sure we all have our ways of approaching this work, and it's probably our unconscious that dictates that too. But I just beginning to enter into some of your writing prompts are amazing, for one. I mean, it's just amazing what you remember. It's a remarkable book. I mean, but you know, I think that people, it's one of those books, and I think many of your books are like this. It's kind of a book that keeps on giving, I sense, because there's a lot to it. It's very approachable, and I, you know, just go right into it, but it will keep on giving over time. I mean, I can see this already. Mm. There's a lot in this book that is of great value.
Oh, well, what a lovely thing to say. Thank you.
Well, it is true. And you know, we don't have, I guess I'm going to give this over to you in the sense of, you know, how much process can we get into the show? I mean, that's a little daunting. Mm. There's just so much in the book. So I'm going to give you a little opportunity. I mean, I suppose, you know, we might start as, you know, how do you get started? That might be, in fact, that first exercise of yours is quite a good one. You have a couple right at the mm-hmm. beginning, and maybe that would give people a feeling for, and even a story from someone maybe in one of your classes, you know, an example of how they responded to the exercise, just like you talk about in your book.
Mm. Well, it certainly is a process, and there are many ways forward. How do we get started? As I've said, we carve out a little bit of time, and we carve out a space, even for that 15 minutes, and we carve out perhaps a notepad. Always try to use the same computer, the same notepad, the same space, and turn up at the desk at the same time each day. And when one is sitting there, as I tried to indicate a little earlier, you know, the unconscious will tell you don't have time and you've got to make a shopping list and you've got to remind yourself to do this, this, and this. One of the things I say is keep a little piece of paper beside you, beside the computer, and as these thoughts pop into your mind, just jot them down. Oh, yes, you know, buy oranges, you know, take car to be fixed. And just jot them down on a separate piece of paper. And one of the things this does is it tells the unconscious, which is jumping around trying to distract us, it says, you've been heard. It's okay. I'll get to those things. You've been heard. And then it starts to say, oh, well, I don't need to bother you anymore then, do I? And it will cooperate with us a little more. But it's also very useful sometimes to have some writing prompts. And one of the writing prompts I like is, well, there are so many, but one of the ones that I think works very well is you just to write down the sentence, I'm here because. And then you say, I'm here because I'm trying to write my memoir. And then you take that last phrase, I'm trying to write my memoir, and you make it the start of the next sentence. So it says, I'm trying to write my memoir because. because it's about time I did. It's about time I did because I've got something important to say. I've got something important to say because, and as we go through this, what we find, and what I've found, I mean, I've been road testing these exercises for decades now.
Yeah.
What people find is they go just a little bit deeper and they say, oh, yes, I'm actually really here because I am a remarkable survivor of some very difficult circumstances and I want to tell that story. And suddenly they have a topic. That's, oh, I'm a remarkable survivor. Wow, what did I survive? And that's when one has a starting point. Another exercise I have people do is I say, okay, you're going to write about your life. You know, that's all right. You've all had wonderful lives, I'm sure. I say, now, write down 12 major events in your life. Just one word. And people say, well, you know, met significant other, married significant other, you know, birth of child, or whatever they write down. They write down 12 events, and sometimes they say, I've got more than 12.
Uh-huh.
And I say, good. And sometimes they say, I can only manage 7. And I say, okay, that's fine. When you've got 12, I say, okay, look at that list and think of the important events in your life in this way. Now, the day you got married, for instance, was an important event. But maybe the day that you decided you were going to marry your spouse was a much more important event because that's when the decision really got made. I don't know. Often it is. So I ask people to look at those 12 events, and then I say, good, you've got your 12, great. And they all look very happy. And then I say, choose 6. So, oh, you can't make me choose 6. Choose 6. We're not throwing anything away, we're just choosing. So they choose 6, they go, oh, all right, okay. And then I say, all right, you got 6? Yes, got 6. Choose 4. Much moaning and groaning. But do you see the process here? When we narrow it down to 4, we're saying, oh, these are the big things in my life that I really do need to talk about at some point. And suddenly you've got 4 major topics that are asking, okay, you can write about me now. And you've got 12 topics at least, which you put on the back burner and say, well, sometime I'm going to write about those. And that's when I tell people, you know, keep that list safe. Keep it in your notebook, because notebooks can't get lost so easily. You know, pin it up on your wall. Do whatever it takes to remember that list. And then you can return to it from time to time and say, ooh, yeah, I should really talk about the time that Uncle Freddy chased me around the yard with a baseball bat, you know, whatever it was. So you know, that sort of technique, that narrowing down technique, because lots of people say, there's so much in my life, I don't know where to begin. And I say, well, here is a way to begin with something. But there's an even more basic technique than this, and that is, I tell my people, I say, begin where the energy is. And they say, what do you mean the energy? I say, well, what feels like it needs to be written right now? And maybe there's a little discussion, and then there'll be almost always an aha moment when they say, I really haven't told anyone about that, have I? And I say, oh, does it feel like that's where the energy is? If so, go with it. Oh, but it's not at the start of my memoir. Don't worry. Go with it. Go with where the energy is. And story will lead on to memory, will lead on to story. It always works like that.
Yeah.
And I call that getting out of your own way. Because so often we say, oh, I've got to start in my early years and work my way through to my middle years and then work my way. No, start where the real, and it may not be where you think it is. It may suddenly come to you, this is what I want to write about. And often if we're in the rhythm of turning up at the table or the desk or the computer 4 times a week, often your unconscious will decide that for you. because whilst you've been at work or looking after the kids or mending the shed roof or whatever it is you've been doing, your unconscious will be saying, yep, I know what we're going to write about when we sit down together. And you'll find almost always that you turn up at the page and the stuff is just waiting to pour out of you. Now, that probably won't happen the first day. That probably won't happen the second day. But it will start happening. And when it starts happening, it will be a bit surprising. It will be, whoa, I didn't realize I had so much. And that's when I say to people, you know, take it gently. Slow down and love your story. It'll wait for you. But it won't wait for you indefinitely.
I'm echoing a little. Hopefully it's okay. It's all right. If people are rushing through, I mean, if they're just, you know, something's really flowing, is it good to let it, to reflect more? I mean, that seems to be what you're advising, that you should should kind of ease that a little bit.
It's a very individual thing. A couple of times I've come across people who've been sort of swept up in the wave and they've written for, you know, 12 hours a day straight for 3 days and then they've sort of collapsed. That's not always the best way because it can take a long time to recover from that.
Yes, yes.
And then there are other people who start off saying, gosh, you know, I couldn't tear myself away from the desk. And I say, that's okay. Just take a break. It will still be there. It will still flow tomorrow. And sometimes that's the better way if one's going to be sustained in what one does. And I think sustainability, I mean, I know it's a buzzword around the halls of power when they're talking about all sorts of things, but sustainability goes for writing a memoir and it goes for writing for even when you're in a job. You know, you don't, you need to be able to say, okay, it's time to stop and go home, even if all the tasks aren't done, and then attack them fresh the next day. So there is a component of thinking it through, of feeling one's way through, of allowing oneself to breathe.
Yeah.
It's not about product. Not about, you know, I worked for 16 straight hours and everyone should applaud me for that. 16 straight hours is pretty admirable. But is this sustainable? Can you keep doing this? And most of us can't. So I think there is a plea to be made here for not exhausting themselves. This is soul
absolutely.
Work. It takes time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Now, what if, and I know you speak of this often, and I've certainly experienced this myself, you'll write something and you'll read it, and you say to yourself, oh my gosh, you know, I can list, you know, about 5 different people. I don't know if they could read that. You know, it's so intensely... Mm-hmm. personal or whatever, you know, it's something that, and I know you say in your book, I mean, obviously you're going to be writing about people that you've encountered in your lives, and so this is a fundamental thing that we're all going to encounter in your book. What do? We just don't know what to do with this. How, you know, how could you really do something with this? And so tell us.
Yes. This is another fundamental question. I'm so glad you asked it.
Yes.
And I get it a lot. People say, well, I can't say that about my Aunt Mildred. I can't say that about Marie. You know, she might read it. They might read it. And I say, well, hold on. We're getting all ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah.
You know, if you are sitting there and you have in front of you a contract that for $1 million to buy your memoir, then you can start to worry about that, I say to people. They say, well, that gives me a few weeks at least. And, you know, there are ways around it. You can change the names, of course. People do that all the time in the memoir. They change the names. But here's the point, and that is when we write memoir, if we're doing the soul work, the first draft might come out as perhaps a little bitter. We might say, yeah. I can't believe my parents did that. I can't believe my sister treated me that way. I can't believe, and fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
As we do the soul work, what we begin to do is we look at it from more than one point of view. And looking at things from more than one point of view, because we stand in a new relationship to our own past when we see it on the page, looking at it from more than one point of view, we may say things like, goodness me, why were they so cruel? Why, what was going on for them that they were so unpleasant? Why were they so... And when we ask questions like that, what we're growing is compassion.
Yes.
And by growing compassion, we begin to see that the people who treated us badly or treated others badly almost always were suffering themselves.
Yes.
It doesn't excuse what they did, but it puts it in a different light. And by the time we've done that, and it doesn't happen in 10 minutes, it doesn't happen in a day, it might happen over a period of a week, 2 weeks, or longer. But when we say that to ourselves, something within us changes because we're no longer willing to condemn them in quite the same way as before. And I've witnessed this firsthand. People who are victims of incest, who have said, well, you know, he was a vicious, selfish figure. You know, I hated what he did. I hated the way he's impacted my life. But, you know, as a result of writing this, I don't hate him anymore. I hate his mental illness or his alcoholism. I hate what happened. But he or she, too, was a suffering soul. And when we're in that space, suddenly everything changes. And we can't be mean, as it were, in the same way that perhaps the first draft might have been.
Yeah.
And sure, you know, someone somewhere might be upset about some of it. That happens all the time, I think. But a lot of the time, it doesn't matter nearly so much as that we grow our sense of compassion. In my father's memoir, he wrote about how his mother, my grandmother, had a very lowly job as a house cleaner, and how rough her hands were. And he wrote about it with great compassion. Now, my mother said, oh, we can't possibly send that out to be printed. You know, that's dear lady. She would never have liked that. That's a dreadful thing.
There you go.
I said, I think you're missing the point. I mean, this is a loving statement about what was genuinely there. And my mother eventually said, she hummed and hawed, and we kept it in, and I'm very glad we did keep it in, A, because it's true, B, because it's a major component of my father's background, and C, because it showed him in a very loving relationship to this hard-working, downtrodden, exhausted lady who was his mother. So, to answer your question directly, by the time we come to our final draft, when Hollywood is ringing our doorbell and waving contracts at us, it's very likely that what we will see is not a softer version, because horrible things do happen and they can't be softened, but a more understanding version of what happened. And so it's not a condemnation. And so we feel very differently about it. And that, too, is part of the soul work.
Yes. You know, as you're speaking of this, I wonder if you've had any experiences where someone puts out a memoir or shares it, perhaps, with someone in their life, and that person says, wow, I never really thought about that's the way you saw that, that maybe it was someone you had a conflict with or something, and that person also heals through the publication or just the sharing of the work. It seems like that could happen, where it brings people together and not just your perspective, but theirs.
Yes, it really does. It brings people together in unusual ways, because often people say, oh, this is what happened. Oh, no wonder I couldn't make sense of what was going on in the family.
Yeah.
One particularly poignant example, a lady who was at one of my workshops, she showed me her memoir, and in it she detailed being sexually abused by her stepfather and how she didn't talk to her mother, who loved her stepfather and was blind to these things, and she continued to agree tacitly, you know, without unspokenly, with the abuse because she wanted to protect her mother and her younger sister. And
yes.
Then 40 years later, 45 years later, she wrote the memoir and showed it to her sister, and her sister looked at her and burst into tears and said, oh, it happened to you too. And these two sisters had been at odds because one thought she was protecting the other from sexual abuse by giving in to the stepfather, and
yes.
the other was also being abused and wanted to know why the older sister wouldn't do anything about it, and they had grown apart, and they had, you know, you can imagine the situation. I don't need to go into all the details.
Yeah.
And then 40 years later, you know, they share the document, and both of them burst into tears and said, I had no idea. I had no idea. Now that brings people back into reality. It brings people back into the heart space of loving each other despite what happened. And it brings, I think, the possibility of real spiritual growth to the forefront.
Yeah.
Sharing the secrets in this way can be so powerful, and you know, it breaks your heart open, but you know, that's the way hearts get opened, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. And I know you speak of, I mean, it can be a very emotional exercise as you
yes.
speak of this, that when people even read some of what they've written in your classes, they'll be crying at times. I mean, that
yep.
this really gets you in touch with who you are, and it's a powerful, powerful thing. Now,
yeah.
I know there's a whole area of your work, and I don't think we're going to be able to get into it probably. There's just not enough time. But you also relate the archetypes to this work, which I find fascinating, how you
yeah.
manage to do this, because it's about life. And I really want to encourage listeners who, if you haven't listened to previous shows with Alan Hunter, you know, go to frontierbeyondfear.com. Actually,
oh, Susan, I lost you.
But what I want
to know. Oh, there we go. You're
know,
back again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What is that? Did you lose me?
I lost you for a moment there. So.
Oh, good. You're back. Okay. I just want to encourage listeners to learn about the archetypes, because that is also reflected in this. You bring that very much forward in this book as well, how to take that understanding. And if you don't know about them, you can learn about them, but within the memoir book itself, but how to understand your life and the process through them. And I don't know, I mean, I guess I'll give it to you to say, you know, what would you like to say about that in the most general way you can, given that I know we don't have too much time, but just that this really goes very deep to understand your life and the process of actually writing the thing through those archetypes.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'd be very happy to do that. The archetypes, as we've spoken about this in previous shows, there are six archetypes that occur throughout Western literature, always in the same order, always doing the same things for over 3,000 years of storytelling. So it looks like they may be deep structures of the psyche. And one of the things I can promise you is that as writers wrestle with their life stories, they will, if they come to mastery of that story, in other words, completing the story, they, the writers, will move through each of these six stages. And so knowing this can be very, very helpful as writers chart their own, as it were, spiritual growth. So I'll do this relatively quickly, but
yes.
if your listeners want to know more, I can point them at the six archetypes of love, my book specifically on archetypes, Stories We Need to Know, which is longer, and to my website. But here's what happens. The first archetype as a writer that most of us get into when we say, oh, I'm going to write my memoir, the first archetype is the innocent. And the innocent says, I want to do this, but you haven't ever done it before, and you don't know how to do it. And so this is a very vulnerable archetype, which is why I wrote the book. I said, you know, such people are like babies. They're full of potential and full of energy, but they don't know how to use it yet. So I wrote the book for people so that they could pick it up and say, what are the first steps, the baby steps, if you will. And then at a certain point following that, when they begin to learn the business of writing on a regular basis, they start looking around in the second archetypal stage, which is the orphan phase. And the orphan, as you might expect, an orphan is looking for a family to belong to.
Yes.
And that's what orphans have to do. Those African orphans we see on TV who are starving, they want a family or an organization that will look after them, just as gang members are orphans who need a pseudo-family to look after them. And the writer at this point is likely to say things like, well, who do I imitate? You know, what's a good memoir? Where do I read it? And can I do one like that? Mm-hmm. And so the memoir writer at that point is likely to say, ooh, I'll write one that's just like, you know, and then you can name whoever the famous memoirist of the moment is. And that's fine. The trouble is, if you're imitating someone else's work, you're probably not doing your own work in your own voice. So I'm patient with such people, and I point them at a variety of memoirs and say, look, there are lots of ways forward. Which one feels true for who you are? And that's a more difficult question. It's not which one is going to be bought by the publisher, but which one feels true. And that's when they enter the next phase, the next archetype. And the next archetype, they've been through innocent and orphan, and now they start asking questions. They start asking questions about what they know, about how they should do it, and about what's true for them. And that is when I compare them to pilgrims, the archetypal pilgrim. Because the pilgrim is looking for truth, not anyone else's truth, but his or her own truth that feels true. That's why pilgrims travel on foot from here to wherever. I mean, in Europe, there is the Camino, which is 500 miles long and can take you, well, there are several Caminos, but the Camino Santiago is 500 miles long, and pilgrims walk every step of that so that they can work out what is true for them. It's not about where you arrive, it's about the process. Now, many writers will ask difficult questions. In fact, they'll interview relatives. They'll say, you know, is that true? You know, what happened there? Do I believe this? And how do I know this? And they'll do research, some of them, and some of them will find it very frustrating. A woman who was whose parents both died very early, leaving her looking after her two or three sisters. She went back through various agencies to find out the placements, why they had been adopted to different families, and she eventually did track down her I think two missing sisters, and found that in some cases they were very different from who she was, and they're so different that there really wasn't much point of contact. They hadn't seen each other since, you know, the age of 8 and 4, perhaps. And asking those questions is vital, but it may not give any real answers that you can hang anything on. Which leads us to phase 4, after the pilgrim. And phase 4 is what I call the warrior lover. And that is the determination of the warrior and the compassion of the lover. And that's when somebody says, you know, this is my story, I am telling it my way, I'm going to tell it as truthfully as I know how, I'm going to be kind, but this is where I'm going with this. And that's a marvelous moment.
Yes.
That's when, usually when writers find what I call their voice, their real voice, and they say, I'm not going to imitate anyone, I'm not going to copy anyone else's style, I'm going to do it the way I want to. That's a very empowered point, the fourth stage. And I think
yes.
most writers can reach that. If you stay in the orphan stage, where you're trying to imitate everyone else's, you may turn out a perfectly nice memoir, but it probably isn't going to reach the deep truth.
Yes.
Warrior Lover, stage four, then gains more and more command of the material. And when he or she is really in charge of that material, that's when the fifth stage is reached, which I call the monarch, or the monarch pair, the king and queen. And that is, instead of trying to wrestle the truth out of every last little bit, they can step back like a king and queen of old and say,
yes.
I think I have all the information. I'm now going to make some executive decisions about what matters and what doesn't.
Yes.
And that's a marvelous point, because it means the sharpness of the focus is really powerfully present. The warrior lover, the previous stage, will want to include pretty much everything.
Yeah.
But the monarch pair, stage five, will say, no, we don't need to include everything. We have enough to get the point across if we only talk about one time this happened, if we only talk about one disastrous family reunion, or if we only talk about one Thanksgiving. So that stage of mastery is what we hope all of us as writers to get to, because when we get there, when we craft our story in this way, it moves not just us, but it moves anybody we share it with. And when our story moves others and makes them go, wow, that's not my life, but look at what I'm learning. My goodness. When we reach that stage, I think that's magic, and I call that stage the magician, the person who is sufficiently in charge of the material to say, this is the episode that I want to write and that you need to read, because it will open your eyes and it will change the reader, as well as having changed the writer in getting to that point. So, at very high speed, these six archetypal phases, as I say, I didn't make them up. They exist in all of literature, in all the great books of the Western canon. They're always there, from Homer through to Harry Potter, of whom I'm a great fan.
Yes.
They're always there, and they always work the same way, because they're life stages. And when we write about our lives, if we're doing soul work, we will go through those life stages until we might not have the ultimate answer to life, living, the universe, and everything. You know, nobody has
yes.
that. But we will have achieved some significant personal truths. And, of course, we know that because suddenly we treat people around us a little differently. Suddenly we treat them with more compassion, more love, more understanding, or more amusement. If we can't understand them, we just laugh and say, well, I don't understand what you're doing yet. Maybe one
yes.
day I will.
Yes.
And that liberates us from the weight of the past. So this whole process is not about going backwards in order to be stuck. This whole process is about going backwards in order gently to take the chains and the shackles off us. And it has to be gentle, because otherwise we hurt ourselves. You know, it's not like in the in the movies where the cowboy arrives with his six gun and shoots the locks off or whatever. You know, these handcuffs and chains and foot fetters and all the rest of them, they have to agree with us to let go.
Yes.
We have to ask for them to let us go, and they will if we ask them the right way. And that's what memoir writing is about. That's really the core of it.
So do you see that people, once liberated, that they do have these paradigm shifts in their life? I know at the beginning you'd say that a lot of times people start this when they're at some kind of turning point, but Does it tend to be the experience of people that once liberated, I mean, they really shift into a much, you know, a paradigm shift is the best way I can describe it. And that liberated.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, as it did for my father, as it did for the prisoner I worked with, as it did for the woman who was exploring incest and was able to talk to her sister. In fact, all of the people I've worked with who have looked at incest, which is a paralyzing experience if one is unfortunate enough to go through it, looking at it has enabled them to shed some of that weight and reactivate lives that perhaps were not going in productive directions. People who've had compulsions and sometimes addictions have been able to say, I see now why I was doing that, and I don't need to do it anymore. It doesn't mean that they will stop doing it entirely, but it does mean they are several steps closer to freeing themselves from compulsions. And you know, many people have compulsions, whether it's a compulsion to buy things, the compulsion to achieve, sex addicts, alcoholics. You know, alcoholics, of course, need specialist treatment, as do hard drug users. But they also need to know why they're doing it so that they can agree to let that go. And so, yes, we shed the weight, our paradigm does shift, our world takes a little step to one side, and we look back and say, gosh, I can't believe I gave my parents, brother, mother-in-law, whatever, I can't believe I gave them all that power over me. Because we do, we give people power to tyrannize us to some extent. I can't believe I wasted all that time agonizing about all those unsuccessful relationships. Now I see it differently. I can let it go. And so, yes, it's a profound feeling of lightness when one lets go of the things that one held on to, perhaps for fear that there would never be any lightness in our lives.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I wonder, we started talking about how at the beginning, you know, you might think about all the people that might read the book and that you kind of put that aside. And yet, you know, just based on even some of my own experience having written in the last year about some of my life, is that you begin to think, my goodness, if this could just help one other person who has been through something similar, if I could help just one person, you know, to maybe navigate that or understand it better, gosh, this is worth it. And to me, that then becomes a motivator to maybe share some things that aren't so easy to share. Just because, and there you go with the paradigm shift in a broader sense, you know, like liberation in a broader sense where you're touching other people.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, our modern world is strangely compartmentalized. And that is, we can, you know, we can live in our houses and not really know our neighbors. We can go to work and not really know the people we work with, even though we might work there for many years. I'm sure that in earlier times, when most people lived in smaller communities, in small villages, pretty much everybody gossiped about everybody else. And so everybody would have known, oh, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they're falling down drunks. Or the Joneses, you know, Mr. Jones beats his wife with sticks every Saturday night. And so all of these things would already be out in the world, and there would be shame, there would be all sorts of negative feelings as well. But the actual facts wouldn't be so strange to us. We would have our siblings living probably very close by, and we could check in with them. We could check in with our grandparents and our uncles and cousins in a way that for many people just isn't possible today. And they would either corroborate what we saw, or perhaps there would be some sort of family conspiracy to stay silent. But sooner or later, someone somewhere in the village would actually say, well, the truth is whatever it is. And so today, more than ever before, we struggle against finding out, or we struggle with finding out what really happened. in a way that perhaps was not quite so difficult or not quite so respected in smaller villages, smaller towns many years ago. So I think this is something we really have to do for ourselves. Many of the people who come to my workshops are in their 50s, and they say, you know, I'm wondering why seeing my children growing up is generating all these emotions for me. Why I'm feeling this? Why? And those are great triggers. But of course, if your children grow up and move away or go to college and never come home, it's very difficult to follow those triggers and therefore find the truth. So I tell people, I think memoir writing is something we all need to do at some point. Maybe in your 50s or 60s is a good stage, earlier if you can. If you leave it too late, and I think the marvelous memoir written by Albert Facey, the Australian, is kind of a great example of this. He wrote this splendid memoir of his life growing up in Australia, and he talked about it and did the circuits, and he was a great, great celebrity. And somewhere around the age of 80, he just said, I don't want to talk about this anymore. And he died, of course, not that long afterwards. But there's a time when it's appropriate to share our wisdom, and we really feel it. We really think we ought to. And there's another phase of life when we go, I don't think so. I did my best. That's it. But unless we do the sharing, we can't grow our souls very efficiently. And even if you share with only one other person, as you say, even if you influence only one reader, you know, it's made it all worthwhile. Nobody should have to learn everything the hard way. They should be able to learn from people like us who've done things the hard way and survived.
Yes, we all do sometimes. Yes. Well, it seems we're getting into the last 3 minutes, and let me just say, I am just so thankful to have you here, Alan, and you know, all that you have contributed to this show and shared with us. And I'm just so delighted that your message today has really been surfaced. I've been kind of watching, and thank you again to Blog Talk Radio. We seem to have gotten as high as number two. And this is not an ego thing. This is a, I am just so happy the message is getting out kind of a thing, because this is about transforming people's lives, and your work is all about that. So thank you so much. And let me tell the audience.
You,
yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, well, thank you, Susan, for making it possible. You know, without you, it would be just another book sitting on a shelf somewhere. But you're doing this wonderful work of bringing this and other wonderful thinkers and writers to the world's attention. So we all owe you a thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'm just very happy that you know, lives are being transformed. And you know, even if it's just a step at a time, just to hear some of the wisdom that you have to share, and as you say, many of the people who have come on this show, it just and it doesn't matter how many. I mean, I'm just happy that the work is helping people. And I want to remind people where to find your work, which is alanhunter.net, spelled with two L's. We always A-L-L-A-N hunter.net is your website. And before the live show goes down, I just want to tell people frontierbeyondfear.com is where to learn about all upcoming episodes and past episodes. You can find them all. And that the next show, and stay on the line, Alan, I'll probably give you one final thank you here for a second, is Thursday, April 10th with Jackie Newcomb. She's coming on at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on Thursday, April 10th. She's going to talk to us about angels and her experience with the afterlife. Very experienced guest in that area. And finally, before the live show goes down, I will be at the Body, Mind, Spirit Expo at the Oregon Convention Center in Hall E this weekend. I will be speaking about Heaven on Earth on Saturday, April 5th at 11 a.m. in room number 1. And I'll be at booth 21, where I'm going to have the books of several of the guests, including Alan Hunter's books, including many of the guests who have been on the show. This is local, so I can bring as many books as I want over there. And I will have them out. And you can just browse through the books. Come and look at Write Your Memoir. Spend as much time with it as you'd like, and then go and buy it on Amazon. So I encourage you to come out this weekend to the Oregon Convention Center. And thank you, live audience, for being here. And a final thank you to you, Alan Hunter, for being here today and sharing such an inspirational message with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a privilege to be part of your show. Thank you.
All right. Well, you take care then.
And you too, Susan. And I look forward to our next conversation whenever that may be.
Oh, yes. In fact, I believe it. In fact, I'll say it to the podcast audience that are going to be out there, that I believe that's Monday, April 28th, that we're tentatively looking at. So
that's what I was hoping.
Yes, that's what we've got you. Well, you're in then. And I don't know that we have time.
Good.
But we'll look at the schedule. Just watch the schedule for Monday, April 28th, and we'll figure out a topic and the time. And I'm so delighted
Perfect.
That you'll be coming back again. So thanks
Me
again.
Too.
And you have a wonderful day, or evening almost,
yes.
in your neck of the woods.
Yes.
Take care.
Thank you, and a wonderful evening to you too, or day to you too, Susan. Thank you.
Yes, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. Bye. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for being here today. And, you know, I wish you peace on your path today. I hope this has been helpful for you and that you can enter into writing the stories of your life. Trust me, it is a very valuable exercise, and you will be surprised at where it takes you. Take care, everyone. ¶¶